Okay, so it's recording now. I'm going to check because you said that there are problems. I know that of one type of problem. The recordings are in a different format, WAM, I think. Okay, here it is. This is our course, class materials. If I click on any of the recordings, nothing else. Okay, this is the reason for that is probably Dropbox wants to. No, not Dropbox. This is the browser. The thing that you can do there is the following. This may be a mismatch in the format, but if you do the following, save as, save link as. After saving, it should be. It should play.
Okay.
It's playing. Yeah. So this may be just some incompatibility in the browser. I know actually what the incompatibility is. Randy Pausch, last lecture. What is it? Why is it playing? Good question.
Is it in the Chrome browser?
I think it's in the.
Yeah, somewhere.
Okay, this is it, I think. This is what's playing. Yeah. Okay. Very good. But how do I. Oh, it's off. Anyway, saving will help saving the thing. Very good. So the next thing that we'll do is. I think I started this, didn't I? Do you remember? Did we finished causal graphs?
Yes.
Did I start with this?
Well, can you go to the next slide?
Does this ring a bell?
We started the. We go to the class in the previous slides.
Oh, so I finished on. Right here. Okay, very good. So we are really at the beginning. Great. So let me duplicate. Okay, we can. Great. So experimental design. So now we have a block of classes that are focusing on the architectures of experiments. Many textbooks teaching research design, which is what this course is about, really, they believe that they often present this as the core of the course. This is really different architectures of experimentation. So let's start with that. There will be three classes, three slides actually, three series of slides. This is the experimental design. Then I'm going to talk about factorial design. Who knows, maybe I will start with it today, if not then next week. And then quasi-experimental designs. This is how they are related. Experimental and quasi-experimental are just designs. The difference between them is that in the experimental designs we have perfect ability to manipulate the independent variable. So we can really do something. In the quasi-experimental designs we don't have the full capability of doing this. So we are conducting experiments typically in some natural setting where we can manipulate a little bit, but not completely. So the border is Actually, the border, I'm not sure if it's fully crisp, but there is a difference between the two. Factorial designs are extending both of these, because most of these experimental architectures involve one variable. You manipulate with one thing, and then look at the effect. In factorial designs, you look at several things being manipulated at the same time. So this is the typical order of things. Usually we have a problem. What kind of problem? Well, we notice that in hospitals, in cancer wards, people who have lung cancer, more of them, I mean, more than in general populations, are smokers. Some of them are non-smokers, but you notice, oh boy, it's like 50% of those people are smokers. And in general population, maybe 10% of the people are smoking. So there is some dependence between the two. Or you notice that among people you know who are smokers, several of them got lung cancer. And people who are non-smokers, you know, maybe one, or maybe none of them. So then, so you see dependence, and that allows you to form a hypothesis. Maybe smoking has something to do with lung cancer. Maybe smoking causes lung cancer. Another example, maybe I may have mentioned that to you already, cervical cancer in women. Again, you know, a terrible disease. Some women were getting it and going to hospitals and then dying. So the question is, what causes it? And then they noticed that nuns in monasteries got almost no incidence of cervical cancer, while prostitutes got more than the general population. So what is it? Why could it be that could it have something to do with sexual activity? And then what is it in the sexual activity that is different between nuns and prostitutes? Well, nuns probably have zero or close to zero, and some of them may be violating the rules, or some of them came to the monastery already after having some experiences. And prostitutes have a lot of different partners. But, you know, there are many women who have sexual intercourse regularly, married women, and they're not getting it, yes? So what is it? People started suspecting maybe there is something being spread, like a bacteria or virus, and that this is the way they discovered that that it's the HPV virus. So usually we have a problem, then we formulate a hypothesis based on our observations, and then we can test it by means of an experiment. So we have a problem. People are dying of lung cancer. We observe correlation with smokers and cancer. So what is it? That correlation can be explained by many graphs. If you look at these graphs, the first one says there's nothing. This is a third variable, the genetic genes, the genetic predisposition. Smoking causes cancer. This is one possibility. The genes have nothing to do with it. And then these three, smoking causes cancer, and the genes, you know, the gene. We know now that there is genetic aspect of cancer. This is also believable. We know that with alcohol, some people are genetically predisposed. They like the taste of alcohol. Just like some people like sweet meals and some people like sour. So some people may like the feeling of warm smoke in their lungs. So in that sense, it's the genes that are influencing smoking. This is, I think, the most likely graph, I think, from what we know today. There is definitely a link from smoking to cancer. We know that there are genetic factors in cancer, but there's also genetic predisposition to smoking, I think. It's just the personal preferences. this graph, I don't think this is true, but this may be that there is no connection between smoking and cancer, but there is a common cause, the genes. People who are more likely to smoke are also more likely to develop cancer. And these four are more of a joke. Cancer causes smoking. How is it possible? Well, you know, maybe you get cancer as a young child, and then at the age of 15, 16, when you start experimenting, smelling smoke, you discover that smoking makes you feel better, like less itchy in the lungs. In that sense, it's the cancer that causes you to smoke. And these are, of course, variations with the genes. So here are nine different graphs that each explain correlation, can explain correlation. So the question is, which of them is this? Before we get into the experimental designs, the question is, what is the value of experimentation? Why do we conduct experiments? It's definitely a very expensive thing. So whenever you conduct an experiment, it's a lot of effort. When you are an engineer, which most of you are, it's not a big deal because most of your experiments are with artifacts, with computer software, with maybe some setup in the laboratory, with concrete, with water, whatever you are doing, with soil. But when you do experiments with humans, and at least I know that Antonina is doing experiments with humans, it's very expensive. You know, finding humans who want to do it. Sometimes you have to pay them. Sometimes they don't show up. They are late. You know, it's a lot of effort. So should we always do experiments? The answer is no. Only when you are unsure about something. Some things are so obvious that you don't even need to test it. We know it. Well, we may be wrong, of course, but we believe that it's not worth experimenting because pretty much we know it. We may be wrong, but probably we are not. So where should you use experimentation? Always when you are unsure, really, or if you have good reasons to think that the current knowledge is wrong. You show it experimentally. So it's an expensive but sometimes necessary route. Before we get into the designs, there are going to be two slides. I'm not going to ask you to read them, just to show you, because we are going to read them in detail later. There is the concept of internal validity and external validity. I would say in Polish it's wewnętrzna spójność I zewnętrzna spójność. I don't know if these are the terms that they are using in Polish textbooks, but I would name them this way. So these are the questions. Is the experiment, is the result really, should we believe it in the experiment? And as you will notice, this is really domain independent. These are really problems with the architecture, with the setup. Here are the internal validity threats. There are eight of them. As I said, we will go into each of them within the next 15 minutes for sure, in detail, what they are doing, how they are working. And then, so the internal validity is, the question is, I observe a difference in the dependent variable. The question is, can I attribute the difference to my intervention? In this very situation in the laboratory. External validity is more about the generalization. So suppose I conduct an experiment. Suppose I can attribute the difference to my manipulation. The question is, can I generalize it to broader situations? Right? Remember the example with intercourse and pregnancy. Right? A typical example would be, suppose you pick your people, your subject, in old people's homes, people over 60, let's say. And then in the experiment, the result is, well, no difference. Whether they have intercourse or not, no pregnancy. Yes? Can you generalize this result to the to what populations can you generalize it? As you, in this situation, you know you cannot generalize it, yes, because your subjects were not well chosen. So these are external validity threats. Again, we'll talk about each of them in detail, so no need to read that now. Just wanted to have a slide with all of them at the same time. Before we get into experiments, the designs, we haven't talked about this, right? Okay. Before we get into the designs, the notation. You will see that in starting from the next slide, the symbols. X for treatment, R for randomization, and O for measurement, outcome or measurement. Time precedence from left to right, and if there are multiple groups, there are different lines. So here is the first design called one-shot case study. What can you see here? You see that there is one group of subjects because there's one line. You will see designs with multiple groups later. But there's one group of subjects. They are treated first, and they are then measured, observed. What would be an experiment like this? I experiment like this regularly when I change the way I teach, for example. Then I have my students like you, and I'm changing something. I do that, and then I observe the effect. I look at your faces, I look at the questions, you know, how you are following the class, etc. So that's a measurement. This is a design that is used very, very widely. Because why is it? It's because it's so inexpensive, so uninvasive. You can just do it everywhere. Children do that a lot. You may have seen children who get who discover a switch of a lamp. They turn it on and they look, oh, light on. They turn it off. On and off, on and off, on and off. They do it many times to make sure that this is persistent, that it always happens. Of course, we as adults get sometimes irritated because they do that because the bulb will, the old type of bulbs will break. They are, every time you turn them on and off, they get hot and cold. It's not good for them. It's a very inexpensive, very simple design. Unfortunately, it has many, many problems. There's a joke that I remember from elementary school when I was really almost a child. A scientist, a biologist, has a frog, and he teaches the frog to jump. He says, "Frog, jump," and the frog jumps. Then he goes to the frog, cuts one of the front legs, says, "Frog, jump," and the frog jumps. He cuts the second leg, front leg, frog, jump. Frog jumps. He cuts one of the rear legs. Frog jump. It's not a very pretty jump, but the frog still jumps. He cuts the last leg. Frog jump. Frog jump. 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 Nothing happens. He writes down in his lab book, when I cut the fourth leg of the frog lost hearing. That's, of course, a silly joke, but it tells you the problem, right? How do you know that what happened is because of your manipulation? You have nothing to compare to. The fundamental problem with this design is that we cannot show that the following inequality holds. You remember the probability of some data, observing some data given the treatment, has to be different than just observing the data. So you want to show that the treatment made a difference, made the probability of the data, the distribution, different. So how can you show this inequality? Essentially, you cannot, because you are measuring only the outcome, the data, after the treatment, but you have no way of saying what the measurement would be without the treatment. We don't measure before the treatment. We don't have another group to compare to. So we cannot even show that this inequality holds. So it's a problem. There are many problems, but we'll talk about them in a moment after the second design, which is a little bit better. Here is the second architecture. In this architecture, they also look very naive, but don't worry, there will be more less naive architectures. So in this case, we have one group of subjects, again, this one line you see. There's a measurement, then there's a treatment, and then there's a measurement again. So suppose I have a class, like well, be bigger than yours, so that we have many subjects. I conduct a test in the beginning of the semester. Then I teach you. I give lectures, maybe some exercises. And I conduct a test at the end of the semester. And I notice, okay, the average score was 43 points, and after the end of the semester, the average is 72 points. I say, oh, wow, my teaching has been great, yes? I improved your knowledge, you know much better now. So now, what is the problem with that thinking? You will notice in this, in the architectures, in general, in conducting experiments, there's sort of common sense. So you will have to think, use your brain, and then use your logic. It has to be common sense, but it should be informed common sense, not just common sense that you are born with, but informed one, because, well, the information is really catching up with the things that people have learned over the last few thousand years. You kind of, that's the idea of education, right? You need to know those things. And then use common sense. So with this design, there are many problems actually still remaining that we can talk about. The basic problem is fixed because I measure, then I measure later after treatment. I have two measurements, so I can say, well, my treatment may have made the difference between the first and the second measurement. Yes? So there's a difference, definitely, in the two measurements. So I attribute that difference to my treatment. So here are the problems. Let's look at them one at a time. The first one, history. What is history? History is just an event happening between the two measurements. So we have two measurements, and we have a treatment in between. And history is an event that happened there, in between. That event may be responsible for the difference in measurements. What would be examples? Here is an example that is from the textbook. I hope it's reasonably appealing. Maybe I should translate it to a few examples that are closer to home. In this case, there was Nazi German propaganda in the United States in 1930s. You know, German Americans were, some of them were sympathizers with Hitler, and they would say, well, no, Hitler is not such a bad guy. He's making order. He's making sure that people are getting work. He did a lot of things, actually. You know, he was vegetarian. He loved animals. He introduced a lot of animal protecting laws, you know, a lot of good things, they said. And that had influence on Americans. The experiment would look as follows. These are the attitude of Americans, let's say, in 1930. This is the attitudes of Americans in 1941. And you notice that people liked Hitler more here than they liked in 1941, despite the propaganda going on all the time. One group, the whole society, all American society, subjected to propaganda, and that propaganda had a negative effect. So you say, well, when there is propaganda, pro-Nazi propaganda, then it has negative effect. But not so, because there were things that happened in the meantime. There was the beginning of the war, attack on Poland. Then there was, first Czechoslovakia, then Poland, and then they moved and conquered France. That has changed the attitude of people. With the propaganda probably was making the people like Hitler more, But something that happened here, right before that, the fall of France, people suddenly realized it's the guy is dangerous. Yes. Something closer to home, I remember once listening to a radio program. I think it was a Polish historian, Jan Nowak, Andrzej Nowak. Andrzej Nowak. He's a professor at Jagiellonian University, and he had wonderful programs in Radio 1. That was like several years, really. They were taken down in 23, you know, the moment, because he's critical of the current government, so they took it down. But you may still find the programs online. I don't know if they took them down. They took a lot of things down, but these are just very neutral, not getting into politics, talking about Polish history. One thing he said, I remember, about the 1920 war. Maybe it was around 2020, 100th anniversary, there was a special program on that. So there was a lot of propaganda, Russian Soviet propaganda, that tried to convince peasants and workers that Soviet Union is a wonderful country, communism is great, especially for working masses. And the propaganda actually was achieving successes. If you watch the movie Bitva 1920, they actually show that little bit of that propaganda. And then Nowak says that when they invaded in 1920, they got into Poland, they had some of those territories under their rule for a few weeks, 2-3 weeks. And Nowak said something like, in those 2 or 3 weeks, whatever the length was, the whole propaganda lasting for 20-something years, sorry, not 20 years, it can't be, 2 years of propaganda, was completely annihilated. People who were sympathizing with them, when they saw the behavior of the Soviet soldiers, the rapes, the stealing, you know, their looks, their behavior, they realized, no way we want to ever live under the rule. So again, very similar example. Well, this example is also from the textbook, but it's Ronald Reagan. All of you were not alive yet when he was a president. That was early 1980s, I think. Very interesting fellow, maybe even late 70s. He started 2 terms. He was an actor, playing typically good guys. There was one movie where he hit a woman, I think. That was the worst that he did in the movie. Handsome fellow, very conservative, and he became a president. They were laughing at him, oh, that actor, you know, a lot of kind of propaganda like that. But he was one of the best presidents of the United States. Many people believe that, even people who are not supporting the Republican Party. He was tough towards the Soviet Union. He would say, no way. And some people attribute the fall of Soviet Union to his tough stand. He was, for example, he started the arms race. Whether he started or not, I don't know, but he didn't want to sign an agreement when it was not in the interest of the United States and it was dangerous. So some people attribute the end of the Soviet Union to his tough politics. And again, you have measurement. Soviet Union, very, very strong. United States kind of having to be careful with them. Then the tough international politics, the treatment, and then Soviet Union falling. Yes, but it, for example, it didn't. It skipped the solidarity movement in Poland that may have contributed to the fall of Soviet Union. There is another problem that can be, we will have it in a few slides, that can explain that example. It's maturation, but that's another thing. Teaching example. I test you, I teach you, and then test you again. Suppose you get hold of old exams from last year. And the reason why you wrote the exam so well is because you saw the exam from last year. Maybe some of the questions were very similar, or maybe the same. That explains how your scores are so high, and not my treatment. Yes. So again, this is something that happens between the measurements, something else that has nothing to do with my treatment, that explains why there is a difference. And there is no way in this architecture to protect you against that. Maturation. I mentioned that this is another explanation of the fall of the Soviet Union. If the measurements were conducted at different times, and there, especially if there is a time distance between the two measurements, there may be some natural processes, like biological, psychological processes, in the meantime that have caused the difference. For example, again, the teaching example. I test you in the beginning of the school year, I teach you, and then I test you at the end. I'm not controlling other classes that you are taking. In general, as time progresses, students become smarter, wiser, they have more knowledge. So maybe the reason why you wrote the exams so well is because of other classes that you took. So essentially, over that period of time, you become smarter, wiser. Here's a good example, actually. Suppose the experiment is very long, takes years. There are experiments that take years. People, typically, it's very natural for people to be very progressive, left-wing when they are young, and conservative when they are old. That's a thing observed in every society, in every culture. So even Churchill said something like, if you are young and not left-wing, then you have no heart. But if you are old and you are not conservative, then you have no brain. That's an actual quote from Churchill. That just states that thing. So now, suppose you have you are subjecting people to conservative propaganda. You're telling them how good it is to be conservative, that people should earn their money, not get the money from the government, etc., etc. And then you measure the attitudes of people through some questionnaire, and you notice that 10 years later, after that propaganda, people become more conservative. Now the question is, can you attribute it to the propaganda? Not necessarily, because over the period of 10 years, people may have naturally gotten more conservative. And another explanation of Ronald Reagan, the tough international politics, is maturation. Essentially, the system, the communist system, was failing more and more. They had they couldn't feed themselves. So whether you are tough or not, economically, they got to a position where they couldn't feed themselves, and they had to fall apart. That's another possible explanation of that. So, and that would be maturation. Sometimes it can be hunger, like you, for example. Here is another example. Suppose you have an experiment on the influence of some treatment, maybe exercise, on weight. Some people become too heavy and they want to lose weight. In fact, I'm a very curious person. When I was a young faculty, I didn't, probably I was leading a less healthy lifestyle, and I noticed I'm a little bit too heavy, like, you know, whatever. Not a lot, a couple of kilograms too heavy. And there was an advertisement for a study on weight loss, and you could, if you participated, you got some financial reward, but I was interested in learning how to stay thin. So I took part in that study, and actually was there. Maybe I'll mention that in another context. But anyway, suppose it was volunteers. So they actually advertised and asked to join people when in that in that study. Now, people who responded were people who were ripe to lose some pounds. Like me, I thought, well, that would be interesting to get rid of that two kilograms of my weight. There may have been some people who had even bigger problems, you know, not 2 kilograms, but 5 kilograms or 10 kilograms. And they were already psychologically motivated. I want to lose my weight. Yes? So now, whether you tell them about the exercises, you tell them what to eat or not, you measure them a year from now, probably they are going to be lighter, thinner. Why? Because they are motivated. They wanted to become thinner. I noticed I had a couple of pounds, couple of kilograms too much. I would probably do something anyway, no matter what. So now the treatment, if you notice the difference between the weight, the difference may be not necessarily to the treatment, but through a natural process that happens in this time. That study was longitudinal, so it lasted for a few months for sure. In a few months, you can lose a lot of weight naturally without even being informed how to do it, without the treatment. So that's maturation. It can be also a thing like hunger. You know, you have an experiment that lasts for an hour or two, and then you feel more and more hungry or more tired. That's a natural process that can account for the difference. Testing. The effect of the test on the score of the second testing. You see, in this architecture, you have two tests, in the beginning and in the end. The direction of the test can be positive or negative. So typically when we take exams, for example, like IQ, intelligence quotient IQ exam, in US, students are taking SAT, GRE tests. These are tests involving many questions, maybe 100 questions. They say that the tests are, that you cannot fake them. So every time you take, it's going to be similar. I don't believe it. I know it firsthand. My fourth son did not study at all for the SAT exam. He wrote it poorly. They admitted him to the university, but they told him to go to one of the regional campuses, to a smaller town. I was angry because he didn't prepare at all. So I got him books with example exams. I introduced a regime. It lasted for a couple of months. Every weekend, Saturday, he was doing a trial test at home. I woke him up at 7 o'clock like I would normally. The exam started at 8 o'clock. 8 o'clock he would start the exam. I would time him. He did example exams. He took that exam at the next opportunity, which was 2 months from then. He was like 30% better, really incredibly better, 30, 40%. And that was, he got admitted within a week to the main campus. He was suddenly very attractive. So you get better every time you test. So you test the first time, you take the test the second time, you get better naturally because you know the type of questions, you know what is asked. As you see questions, views may become more extreme. You may have been all in the situations when you are among friends. I know it happens among men. I don't know about women. If that thing happens, you know, somebody makes a joke. Somebody else makes a joke with a dirty word. The next joke is going to be even dirtier. Then they quickly deteriorate to one of the favorite topics among men, you know, jokes with sexual character and bad words, and it gets kind of worse and worse with time. It's a natural thing for humans. The views can become more extreme. So, you know, the first time you meet somebody, you're kind of very polite, you avoid topics, but then as you start talking, you can become more extreme in your political statements or whatever statements. So when you get the first questionnaire, for example, the next time you get that questionnaire, you become essentially more extreme because you realize that the type of questions that are being asked in those tests suggest that it's socially more approved or permissible to answer one way or another. This is an example of a physical effect. Again, I would not draw too strong of conclusions because the example was conceived several decades ago, maybe 1960s, 70s. Today we know how to do it much better. The Rntgen photographs, we know that radiation can influence the probability of cancer. So women who are advised to take mammograms, which is Rntgen photographs of the breasts, of course, that's the idea is that you discover if there's anything happening, you discovered it early. But that test by itself increases the probability of cancer in the future. So you have real influence, physical influence of the testing on the other test. But today, those tests are so good that the amount of radiation that you get is really minimal. Overall, it's definitely advisable to take those screening tests. They save lives. But in theory, there is an effect, yes, of testing. Instrumentation. Instrumentation is another thing that can happen. You have two measurements, and suppose that the instrument gets decalibrated between the two measurements. Decalibrated means has different standards or different measures. Something has changed in the instrument. As an interviewer, suppose that the measurement is an interview, asking questions, writing down the answers. Interviewers can become more experienced as the experiment progresses. So in the second round, so they interview all the subjects in the beginning, then there's a treatment, maybe it's longitudinal, it takes days or weeks, and then they interview all the subjects at the end. They are more experienced in measuring, in interpreting the answers. So they have a different standard here. Teachers tend to lower their standards as they go, beginning teachers. I don't know if you have experience teaching, but I remember when I was first teaching, straight after my PhD, I was very ambitious, coming from a good university, high standards, and then I realized that the kids at my university, there where I was working, they were not that great, and many of them didn't have the computer science backgrounds, so it was actually quite difficult. So I had to lower the standards in order to be reasonable with them. I lowered the standards, maybe in the next semester too, but then I realized that's a one-way street, so then I went back again. Not all the way up, but definitely standards are standards, so... But it's a natural thing that a beginning teacher lowers the standards. So when they test the kids later, they are not the same instrument that was in the beginning. A computer science example, well, anybody who does simulations with computers, suppose you are using a department computer. There are not so many these days, like bigger computers that everybody is using. Most of us use workstations, but in the past, suppose that the system administrator changed the clock speed. So, the clock has changed and you don't even know, but the next time you measure, you get a different measurement because of that. Statistical regression is one of the most difficult, but also fascinating, interesting. Let me try to demonstrate you. Let's see. Forgot your first name, sorry.
Arthur.
You seem to be very tall. How tall are you?
1.98.
That's a lot. Yeah. Do you have brothers?
No, sister.
Okay.
Younger sister.
Okay, I'll make another. I'm willing to make a small bet that you are taller than your father.
Yes.
Ah.
Yeah, sure.
And how tall are you?
1.75.
Oh, that's not very tall. You have a brother?
Yes, two.
I'm willing to make a small bet that they are taller than you.
No.
No. Oh.
Almost the same. Okay.
Why did I make... I have no idea how tall you are within your population. So again, that's why I didn't ask you. Are you tall or short?
Average.
Average. Not a safe question. why did I make those bets? It's because of a phenomenon that is known as statistical regression. Let me try to explain it to you. Suppose that this is Arthur's genetic height. What I mean by genetic height is, if you had your brother, sister, your mother, your father, in your family, the family tends to be whatever the average is. I don't know. Let it be 180. It's a probably tall family. Now I'm observing an individual who seems to be quite tall, 198. That's actually well above the average in Poland. So I'm suspecting, taking a risk, that within your population, your genetic predisposition, you are probably on the higher end. That was a bet. I didn't know for sure, but 198, I haven't seen many families that tall, but everybody was that tall. So I suspect that within your genes, you are here somewhere. And again, there would be nothing wrong with you being here or here or here. Anyone is. It just depends on which seed gets into the egg of your mother. So I assumed that you are from here somewhere. And then please note that the bet, your father is taller, the probability of that is, assuming that the father comes from the same population, has the probability of that much, the area under the curve. The bet, the father is shorter, has much, much bigger probability. Because it's, that whole area. That's under the assumption that you are an exception in the family. But that's not a very bad assumption, assuming that I see that you are very tall. Regression to the mean, is called. And this is the mean, and the next time I measure somebody from your population, I bet that person is going to be closer to the mean. Other examples. Suppose that you observe a very, very bad behavior in a child. You go to a restaurant, the child gets to the floor, starts stamping, screaming, really bad behavior. And then, as a parent, you have a choice. You give a penalty for that, for the behavior, or you praise or whatever else. And typically, what happens is, we think, okay, he behaved very badly, I penalize, and it worked. The next day, the child is like an angel. Or the other way, the child is very, very good, I praise the child, you have a very good behavior, the next day the child is bad. And you think, oh boy, praising the child had a negative effect on the child. Not so. In fact, from psychology we know that praising, for good behavior of course, is much more effective than penalizing for bad behavior. Nothing wrong with both of the activities, but we know that praising is actually better. But as people, we attribute that bad behavior after praise as, the praise had a bad effect. But it's not so. Suppose this is the average for that child. That child is, as good, this is the amount of noise that the child makes or the amount of bad remarks or whatever. That's the average. The child will have bad days when gets up with a left leg, as we say in Polish, or a very good day. When we observe exceptionally good behavior here, it's essentially here, within the complex construction of the child, who is just a human. We all have bad and good days. That was exceptionally good behavior. No matter what we do, the next time we observe the behavior, it's going to be closer to the mean. Just because it's more likely than being even better than that. The same when we observe exceptionally bad behavior, no matter what we do, the probability of good behavior, better behavior, is going to be higher than probability of even worse behavior. So that's how regression to the mean works. And now, why this example? How does it work in the experiments? It works as follows. Suppose that you select your subjects from an extreme population. Suppose it's in a school setting, and you ask the children to write a test, and then the children who wrote the test the most poorly, you say, okay, you need some remedial classes. So we give you extracurricular classes so that you catch up with the other students. Next time you test those kids, what will be the result? They're going to do it better on the average. Yes? Why? Because of your treatment? Maybe. But there was also a strong effect of regression there. They took one test, they wrote extremely badly. Next time they write it, they're going to write it probably better than that. If you pick children based on one test, of course, who wrote it the best, and you give them to a special class for very bright children, that was being done in US. There were children for the, when my children were small, children who were, they thought, exceptionally bright, they took them one day a week to a special school where they had more challenging assignments. But it was sound if that was based on a judgment by the teacher who knew the kids over the period of several weeks at least, and not based on one test. So if they observe the child takes several tests, you know, they observe the child, they notice it's a bright child or a child that needs help. But based on one test, it's a poor idea. So statistical regression will happen when you select people from extreme population and then you subject them to some treatment. I gave you that example. A program for smartest kids, I also gave you that example. A computer science problem. You try a new algorithm for avoiding congestion in communication in a network. To test your algorithm, you pick the nodes with the highest congestion on a given day for the test. And what happens? With your wonderful algorithm, the congestion in those nodes is going to be lower. But it can be also attributed to the fact that that congestion was just exceptional that time, that day. It would be lower no matter what algorithm you pick. So we have to be very careful, especially when the selection is based on extreme outcomes. So here's a picture of all the threats. These are the selection criteria of the population. But that was always the case. I mean, the first and second design. Pre-test can influence the post-test in the sense of working hard or knowing, influencing the dependent variable you get the post-test. So it's not the treatment, but the pre-test that influenced the variable. So the dependence between the two can be through alternative paths, like this. Third design. There's going to be, I think, 8 designs of these, and then 4 or 5 of quasi-experimental. But it's going to be easier and easier to understand them once you get used to them. This third design has 2 groups. Suddenly, we are in a much better position than having one group, because we have a group to compare to. So 2 groups, we select them, and we treat only one of the groups. That's a design that occurs a lot in natural settings, for example, in education. If I experiment with different methods of teaching, for example, I may do it one semester, use one method, and then another semester, I compare it to another semester where I didn't use that method, for example. I have 2 groups. They are conducted at different times. What would be other example? Oh, I have two sections of the same class. lecture is common, but then exercises are, laboratory exercises are in different groups. I can treat them differently. But then there are problems with design. So I can compare them, but there are problems with this design. What are the problems? The first problem is selection. Of course, the previous problems like history can happen here also. If I have one group 1 year and another group another year, then something can happen in that year that didn't happen in the other year. If I have two sections of the same class, this section is meeting on Wednesday morning, this section is meeting Wednesday afternoon. Wednesday morning there can be something, fire in the building, or interruption of the Wi-Fi in our building, which happens a lot, by the way. That didn't happen in the other group, right? So things like that can happen. So all of these things can happen still, but if you conduct the experiment at the same time and you can eliminate the history by careful setting the conditions of the lab, then it may not happen. But the new things that can happen is selection and mortality. Selection is selecting people to the different groups. People, animals, or pieces of equipment that you are testing. There is really no formal way of certifying that the two groups would have been equivalent if not for the treatment. So if I have two sections of the same class, how can I certify that they are the same? In fact, there are many reasons why they are not the same. Those of you who have taught, once you start teaching, you will know it experimentally, that every year the students are different. It's amazing, you know, you teach the same class, but every year there's a different dynamic of the class. There are some people who are leaders in the class, some people who are jokers, and the whole class is either very active, they are asking questions, they are talking with you, and another year in the class, they don't ask questions, they are quiet, they are just listening. Some years they are very successful in terms of their learning, other years not. The same with sections. I think sections, even if it's like Wednesday morning, Wednesday afternoon, they can be different people. In our university, they usually, in my department, they select them by the last name. So the first section is, let's say, from A to K, the second section is from L to Z. Why is that making them different? I didn't look at your last names, but I bet that those of you who start with A, B, C, D were often the first ones being asked at school. The teachers typically, you know, start from the beginning of the book. Those of you who were close to Z or K, they were probably left alone in the beginning more often than the others. Another thing, those of you, suppose the selection in the groups was not done by the dean's office, but voluntarily you sign up for the. People who are assigned in the morning or in the afternoon, they are different. Why? Because those in the morning maybe didn't have their coffee yet, for example. Yes? Or they just finished their breakfast and they are not hungry and they can think better. People in the afternoon are already tired after other classes in the morning. So the two groups are different. And there's no formal way of actually certifying that they are the same. How would you? They are typically naturally occurring groups. And if not naturally, and you select, how do you select them? Suppose I select for my experiment with smoking, I select by the color of the eyes. Brown, you are a non-smoker. Blue, you are a smoker from now on, Antonina. Brown, non-smoker, and blue, smoker. And what if the color of the eye has something to do with those genes that make it more likely to develop cancer, lung cancer? So now I select people with brown eye to the control group, blue eye for the treatment group, and I realize, oh, how nice, I have good results. The treatment group, I see an effect, more cancers in that group. That's not nice, actually, but it can happen. But actually, the way I selected my subjects, based on the color of the eye, or sex. Women cannot smoke. I assign all the women to the non-smokers, men to the smokers, right? And what if sex has to do with cancer? Maybe men are more likely to get cancer, yes? So whatever criteria you are using in selecting people, they can result in that correlation between the treatment and the effect. No formal way of certifying that. Examples plenty. I just gave you some color of the eye, sex, morning or afternoon, in the two sections. So many, many examples. Those selection criteria, the important thing is that the selection criteria have to do something with the outcome variable and with this. And there can be dependence through that variable, the selection criteria. The second thing that is new is experimental mortality. The last one will come up later, in the probably next week. What is it about? It is about not real dying, but it's about exiting the experiment. As you may know, if you have conducted any experiments with humans, Antonina has done it, you probably had to ask the subjects to sign a consent form. That's a requirement in most places. In that consent form, you describe the experiment without telling them the real thing, of course, that's blinding. But you tell them you are going to be asked about sounds that you hear through your headphones, and an obligatory statement: if at any point you have any concerns and you want to exit the study, you can just tell it and you can exit the study, right? In most experiments, humans have to have this opportunity to exit the study. Imagine a study where you are testing influence of exercise on weight. I told you that I participated in a study like this. I was in the treatment group, and there were two treatment groups and a control group. One group was given literature on what to do and instructions about food. Our group was exercising. We were exercising once a week, running with somebody from the study, and then we were instructed to run every day at home. Okay, so that I was in a treatment group. Suppose that, and there were people who are volunteered, for example, for that. People who think they should lose some weight. People who are the most obese, they are the fattest, the heaviest. They suppose they are in the treatment group. What happens? They are asked to run. They have sometimes difficulty with walking, especially with the American obesity, for example. They may have difficulty with walking. And then running, they get heart palpitations. They cannot do it. And at some point they say, oh, no, it's too hard for me. I have to exit that study. And what happens at the end of the study, 2 months later? You weigh everybody in that group, and you discover that the average weight is low. Why? Because the heaviest people have exited the study. In the other group, the average weight is whatever it was. They had no reasons for exiting the study. They came after 2 months to get money for the participation, so the weight is whatever it would be normally, the weight. And this is lighter. Can you attribute that lower weight to the treatment? No. It's purely due to the mortality. That's more of a joke. Smoking on lung cancer, you can deal with the real mortality if the study lasts for 10 or 20 years. Some people can literally die from smoking. This is a thing from the textbook. I didn't invent it. The textbook is a few decades old. So I guess it's not completely politically correct. But anyway, Some people apparently claimed that that college education has very bad effect on beauty. So men become less handsome, women become less pretty after college education. That's of course fallacious reasoning. It's completely wrong. What happens? People who are very handsome are very popular. They have many girlfriends. You know, it may happen that the girlfriends become pregnant. They can no longer afford to study because they need to take care of their child and of their wife if they get married after that. So they drop off. They stop their studies. Women who are very pretty, well, they are the ones who get pregnant, right? Or they get married. And they also exit the studies. So among the college graduates, the average beauty, whatever way you measure it, because I feel that everybody is beautiful, definitely, for me, every woman is beautiful, has something that is really beautiful. I don't think I've ever met a really ugly woman. Whatever way you measure it, but suppose you measure it in some way, the beauty, you measure the college graduates, they are less pretty than the population, right? And then you can draw the conclusion, it's the college education, the treatment has made them less pretty. It can be explained by mortality, essentially. So again, mortality, the treatment, causes differential exiting of in the groups. In the treatment group, there can be more exits, or the other way. There can be also the other way, of course. And then when you test it, you notice that the dependent variable has changed, not because of the treatment, but because of the mortality. Now, the first very, very nice design, very young. The idea is not very old. It's just beginning of 20th century. So it's pretty much 100 years ago. The idea that if you want to conduct an experiment, you can randomize. Randomization, you've seen this slide already. You use a coin or a randomizer in a computer. In any case, something that you know reasonably sure that has nothing to do with the dependent variable. That's the idea. It's not the randomization, but it's the idea that your selection criteria has nothing to do with the outcome variable. Can you find easily such criteria? Suppose I select you based on the color of your clothing. Dark, dark, you are going to be smokers. Light, light, non-smokers. Does it have anything to do with the outcome? Well, let's think about it. It could. Maybe the preference for dark clothing, I have mainly light clothing, maybe the preference for dark clothing has something to do with the genes, just like, you know, preference for sweet dishes, for smoking. Maybe preference for clothing has something to do with smoking. Please know that whatever you choose, whatever criterion you choose, there may be somebody criticizing. Oh, wait a minute, you have not eliminated this connection between the criterion and the outcome variable. So if you have a selection criterion, it may influence your selection, but also has something to do with the outcome variable. Of course, the color of the clothing, you can say, you are looking too far. But if you randomize, you are reasonably sure that this selection criterion has nothing to do with the outcome. Of course, you can start thinking magic. You got heads in your coin. Huh? Now that's a bad sign for you. That it may cause you to have cancer, right? But nobody will believe that. Nobody reasonable will believe that. So this is the main idea. Have a selection criterion that will be independent of the lung cancer. Also, will cause the perfect manipulation of that independent variable. So if there is any other connection, it becomes inactive. It's not there, essentially. So that's our first experimental design. This is the asbestos. Other things that will exposure to some people get it from, let's say, indoor air pollution, like oil that you cook, that you fry. It can also cause problems with lungs. Some smells, maybe some chemicals, paints may also cause lung cancer. They will only cause variation. Some people who are non-smokers will get cancer too. If there are some positive things for the lung, maybe some smokers will also be less likely to get cancer. But this will be just variation. The fundamental thing, the dependence, will be untouched by those. Here is the symbolic notation of that design. We have two groups of subjects. We randomize the two groups. We randomly assign to the two groups. So in this example with smoking, I would go for every one of you, flip a coin, tails, you are non-smoker now. Heads, you are a smoker now. You see, the only cause of smoking is the outcome of the coin. You cannot connect the coin with cancer. So that's the role of the randomization. And then we have measurement. We test if there is a cancer. Now we treat, and then we measure later. So this group is the smokers. We made sure that they had no cancer in the beginning. They are smokers, and then we test at the end. How does it deal with the threats? How many threats? 7 threats that we had so far. Now, history, it would have to happen to only one group and not the other. If anything strange happened, it would have to happen to one group and not the other. It can still happen. Suppose I meet with my first group in one room and meet with my second group in another room. I conducted my experiment looking at the strength of concrete. On one day, I have a certain type of concrete. On another day, I have another type of concrete with a mixture that I added with some chemicals that are making it stronger. So, good experiment, right? I randomly decided that Wednesday is the first, Thursday is the second, for example. But now, look what could happen. The cleaning person could have opened the window. She comes in the evening. Well, when your concrete settles, she could have opened the window on that evening, and you didn't even know about this. And she wouldn't do it on Thursday, just Wednesday. So it still can happen. You have to be aware of all of those things happening, but this design allows you easily to deal with that. So as long as you make sure that the two groups are identical except for the treatment, history cannot happen. Yes, because if it happens to one group, it happens to another. And then the difference, you can compensate for that, the history thing. There will be a difference between 03 and 04 because of the history thing. It's going to be here also. But the difference between 02 and 04 is going to be because of your treatment. So you can compensate that. Maturation and testing are also controlled. You are using the same device here and the same device here. So testing cannot happen. Well, still can happen when you are measuring them on different days, for example, different times. Still can happen. You have to be careful. But as long as you make sure that they are identical, the groups treated identically with the same measuring device, then you are protected. Maturation, well, if they mature, why don't they mature? They don't mature in the same way. So the same thing. It's not no longer a threat to the design. Influence of testing, instrumentation. That's what I wanted to say, that the same device, you test them here and here. Of course, if you process them on a different date, you process them individually, you need to make sure that they are treated in the same way. And one thing that people do is they record or videotape the interview to make sure they can observe it later if they were treated differently, if anything's happened differently. Regression, again, it's not a great idea to do it, but you can still do the the kids that perform worse or better, the extreme selection, but regression will happen in the first group and in the second. So if this group will write better, the same will happen to this group. So the difference between O2 and O4 is purely due to the treatment. And the architecture gives you tools to protect yourself. Selection, that's ruled out completely, because selection to the groups happens only through the randomization. There is no other mechanism that puts people in the first or second group. If you have sufficiently many subjects, the probability that the groups are identical, well selected, becomes very, very high. Of course, suppose I have 40 people, my subjects, and I flip a coin for every one of them. Suppose I have 20 women and 20 men. I flip a coin for every one of them, and it happens so that all the men get heads and all the women get tails. So all the women go to one group, all the men go to other group. Can it happen? Sure, it can happen. But what is the probability of that happening? It's 1/2 to the power of 40, yes? That's an astronomical number. Actually, not necessarily. To the power of 20 is enough, I think. Because in the first 20 throws, if you get all the men, all the women are determined for the second group. 1/2 to the power of 20 is a very, very small number. So it may happen that your randomization will give you biased groups, two different groups, which makes your assumption about that the groups are identical wrong. But the whole machinery of statistics is working for you. The groups are identical. The probability that they are identical is very, very high. Mortality is still a problem because generally it's hard to handle that. People try to avoid mortality if they can in a variety of ways. One thing is in experiments with humans, for example, when you have animals and things, no problem. You will have no mortality. Unless some animal will die on you or so, for different reasons. But with humans, you have the problem of mortality. How do you make it smaller? Well, you can make the payment at the end of the experiment. That's legal. It's not legal to penalize them. If you exit the study, you have to pay a penalty. I don't think we can do that. Maybe we can, but I don't think it's we do that. But you can give the reward for the experiment at the end of the experiment. And if they exit earlier, which they have the right to, they don't get the payment. That prevents many people from exiting the study. This is kind of an explanation. If there are things happening with the pre-test, post-test, you can definitely compensate for that because you have a way of compensating between the two groups. If it was the pre-test that made the post-test different, then it happens in both groups. So it's the difference between O2 and O4 that is of essence. But now there are problems to external validity. Let me see if we can. There are three threads. I have 5 minutes left, so let's see how far we can go with that. These are the threats to external validity in the sense of us being able to generalize the results to wide, broader populations. Remember this problem in philosophy of science, the problem of induction. After seeing 9,999 black ravens, you cannot say for sure that all ravens are black. You may well in the future see an albino raven that is white. So we can never say with absolute certainty, also with generalization. But you cannot solve that logically, but you can point out some possible problems. One problem is interaction of testing in which the pretest causes the increase of the respondent's response. And that happens typically in artificial environments. I don't think, by the way, I will be able to go beyond this effect. And what can happen here is subjects can be sensitized by to the treatment by a pretest. Textbook example in American textbooks is giving a movie on the topic of antisemitism. That's an old movie, I think it's 1950s or 60s, called Gentleman's Agreement. And it's a movie about the topic of antisemitism. The story goes as follows. This young journalist, Gregory Peck, he was a big movie star, still well-known during my childhood. He was playing in the original, kind of horror movie where he played the original husband. Anyway, he played in many good movies. In this movie, he plays a journalist, and he is given a task to write an article about antisemitism. Antisemitism, by the way, was popular all over the world. Poland was, in fact, Polański, Roman Polański, he said once that he and his parents moved back from France to Poland because of antisemitism, which kind of, an interesting thing. So it was everywhere, including Poland, of course. In US, it was well into 1950s or 60s even, antisemitism. So he is given the task. And then his fiancée has an idea, saying, well, you cannot really write an article about it if you don't experience it on your own. You should talk to some Jewish people, or maybe even better, I forgot if she was given him the idea of, or the idea was his idea after what she said, he decides to pretend being Jewish. So, kind of without making a big fuss about this, he says to some of his colleagues, to somebody, I'm very interested in this topic of my article. It's not because I'm Jewish, it just interests me, right? So he kind of signals that he may be Jewish. And then he experiences antisemitism firsthand. Then terrible things are happening, like he goes, he makes a reservation for a weekend with his fiancée in some resort, upstate New York, Catskills, some very nice place. And then he goes there, and they tell him, Mr. whatever he was, he used, I think, a Jewish sounding name, whatever, Schwartz or Cohen or something. And they said, well, we are very sorry, but there is no reservation under that name. He experiences this several times. He wants to join a golf club. When they look at his name, which he gave it again, Jewish sounding name, we don't accept. I don't know if they told him the Jews or we are full, whatever. He experienced many problems like this. The title of the movie, Gentleman's Agreement, is his fiancée says, of course, Jews are not accepted to the country clubs. Is there any law against that? No, it's kind of a gentleman's agreement. We don't accept Jewish people here. This guy was his friend who was actually Jewish. So that movie is a movie about antisemitism, what kind of treatment people get. Now, an experiment in which you, in the beginning, test the pretest is a questionnaire testing the degree of antisemitism, essentially makes people sensitive. The way they perceive the movie is different than if they just watch that movie independently without an experiment. So that's the idea. The pretest can make you more sensitive to what you get. A pretest can actually make the treatment work stronger or weaker, whatever. So that's the example. The time is up. My time is up. So we'll have to talk about the other two next week. They are all interesting and fun. Again, the list of threads, it's a good idea to be aware of them. In case you are designing an experiment, think about for a moment, can something like that happen? Some difference in treatment. Very good. Thank you very much. I haven't checked the presence, but I think all of us are here. Let me quickly check the presence. We have, sorry, this is the Methodologie Banane Experimentale, 26. I think there are five, and the fifth one took this course last year. He was still, or 2 years ago, and he was a master's student. He attended all the, so I told him, you don't need to. Thank you, everybody is there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The dates are wrong, right? I'll change the dates. Thank you.
Thank you.
I need to change the dates. I need to remember about this.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Co?
Nagranie.
O, dziękuję bardzo. Dziękuję.